Good morning. So does a mantra like that have life for us? It has been chanted historically by people who had a sense of it that we might think of as magic. But we'll talk about that a bit, I hope. But we have several things to do today. So we'll begin where we ended off yesterday. It was 39 years ago that I first chanted the Heart Sutra. And maybe that gives you an idea of how old this brain is and how hard it is to remember anything from then. I can't say that I remember anything particular about chanting the Heart Sutra, about my first chanting of the Heart Sutra. Or actually for some time thereafter in my practice at Minnesota Zen Center with Katagiri Roshi. In those first times of chanting, there's so many things to be aware of in a context that you're completely unfamiliar with that the Heart Sutra, I think, was part of a kind of blur of many unknown things, things difficult to decipher. But what do I remember? The memory that's so important to me is kind of in my bones, if not in my living fully or very adequately. And that is the importance of being there and doing what we were doing as a community, which was clear not from the words we were reading, but to the strength and clarity of Katagiri Roshi's presence and the dedication of other priests who had been part of his circle before me. And where did that strength and clarity come from? It's not something conveyed, well, it's a little bit conveyed by his words, but most of us didn't understand an awful lot of what he was talking about for an hour and a half while we tried to be comfortable sitting on those cushions. It was something else. Something in the strength of his heart of devotion. Devotion is the best word I can think of for it. So I want to begin this morning with a story about devotion. Which has a lot to do with how the Heart Sutra comes to us. It's a story about the person who made the translation from Sanskrit to Chinese that is the basis for all the translations, English translations, we are familiar with. His name is Swansong. And some of you familiar with Kaz Ta-Nehisi's book on the Heart Sutra have probably read or heard this story. Swansong was a young man in China in the 7th century who developed a great interest in Buddhist sutras. And he was aware that they had very few of them in China, that there would be many more available in India in the Sanskrit literature. And he developed a deep intention to go to India. And his trip is quite a story. The emperor prohibited any travel outside of China. He decided he just would not let that stop him. In 629, he broke the imperial decree and set off for India in search of the Dharma. It was an astonishingly difficult trip in those days. Parts of it, I'm sure, on what we've come to know as the Silk Road. He got some companions together to help and hired a guide, and they set off. Walking for days and days and days, getting into the Gobi Desert of far western, what is now far western China, he managed to get past the guards. He got lost walking for days and days in the brutally scorching sun. Maybe hallucinated, he found himself surrounded by grotesque evil spirits. He invoked the name of his guardian deity, who was Avalokiteshvara, but the spirits persisted to haunting him. So finally he began chanting the Heart Sutra fervently, and the spirits were finally driven away. And he remembered that many years earlier, he had come across a poor monk who was destitute, his body covered with sores. And he got this monk to a monastery where they found some money and some nourishment to help him and nursed him back to some degree of health. In his gratitude, the monk taught Swan Song the Heart Sutra. And he continued to study and chant it for the rest of his life. When they passed through one kingdom, the monarch spent some time with him and was immediately impressed with the depth of his knowledge and his commitment, and asked Swan Song to stay as a teacher for his kingdom. Swan Song, however, would not be deterred from his journey, so he refused and he went on a fast. And after he had fasted for 3 days, the king saw his great determination. And he allowed him to go on with certain requests. He wanted him to stay for 1 month, and so he gave Dharma talks there for 1 month. And then the king gave him an offering of gold and silver and hundreds of rolls of silk, letters of introduction to 24 kings that he might be meeting, 30 horses, 2 helpers. Enough, it is said, to sustain his journey for 20 years. I guess there was a 1% club in those days, too. Shortly after I started out again, they learned that a group of bandits had just killed all the Iranian merchants in a group ahead of them on the road. But at this point, they had enough money to buy them off. After that, the great Khan of the Western Turks tried to persuade him to stay in his kingdom, but again ended up giving him letters of safe passage for his journey. In another kingdom, the world was pretty divided then. It said that a number of Theravadan monks greeted him with music and feasting. 3 months into his journey, he had to cross high mountain paths covered with glaciers. And there he lost one third of his crew and many of his horses to freezing and starvation. There were more events. But once into the Indian subcontinent, he was able to visit many important Buddhist sites and really begin the study of his interest. In the summer of 632, Xuanzang, that begins with an X, X-U-A-N-Z-A-N-G, Xuanzang, I guess it would be. In 632, he arrived at the great Nalanda Buddhist University in the kingdom of Magadhi in northeast India. There was his great library of Buddhist sutras in Sanskrit. He studied Mahayana, he studied Yogacara philosophy, studied Mahayana and earlier scriptures, found many sutras that was the intention of his journey. But he spent some time there with his studies and his work. 16 years after he started his journey, he returned to the capital of China. It is said that hundreds of thousands of people came out to greet him. And eventually, Xuanzang undertook a big national project to translate a great number of the Sanskrit scriptures he had found into Chinese. Many scholars and calligraphers were engaged for the project. The king, rather than punishing him for disobeying his edict, gave him a great deal of support for the project. The record indicates that Xuanzang translated the Heart Sutra on the 24th day of the fifth month of 649, 1,366 years ago. Kaz Ta-Nehisi comments, Xuanzang's fresh use of words in translation, combined with his high degree of accuracy, stimulated a surge of Buddhist studies and thoughts, resulting in the rise of the golden age of Buddhism in China and beyond. Xuanzang died in 664. It is said that over 1 million people came to bow at his coffin, and over 30,000 people stayed overnight at his tomb. I know enough about how some religious history has been written in China to suppose that there may be some elaboration in some of those events in his story. But the sutras were translated, the sutras were brought to China. and our tradition, our own practice and study at teaching owes a great deal of debt to Swan Song and all that happened in that story. Over 600 translations were completed. That is a story to me of devotion, of dimensions of devotion, the kinds of dimensions of devotion that I witnessed in Katagiri Roshi that we don't always think about when we say that word devotion. We use that word devotion to talk about the wearing the clothing, the language, the artifacts, the clothing of that reminds us of who we are and where we are and what we are together to do. Our session consists of many elements of our devotion. But devotion is also work and sacrifice. So Swanzong's story reminds me of Katagiri Roshi. And much the same of Suzuki Roshi, whom I did not know personally. When you think of the practice that we have, the depth of understanding and ability to communicate this practice and demonstrate this practice that we see in many of our teachers, we see something of that great heart of devotion, but we see it as we saw it, as we see it in a story like that of Swan Song. We see it in hard work and sacrifice. And of course, many other ways. Katagiri Roshi worked very hard. He came to Minnesota at the behest of a group of people deeply and strongly committed to having a practice center here in Minnesota. Without any clear knowledge that they would be able to come up with the resources to support him and his family. The first plan was for him to come by himself, leaving his wife and two sons in San Francisco, where the Zen Center there could give them some support. But eventually they came, they were all able to come. They lived very modestly on the second floor of what is now the Minnesota Zen Center, Meditation Center. He had on his desk a Japanese English dictionary that was about this thick. It was a huge volume. And he used it constantly. He worked and worked at expressing the Dharma for us Westerners. We are here out of our devotion to a path fully dependent on the devotion of so many who went before us. One of Katagiri Roshi's great contributions was the design of a practice period that would work for a non-monastic community. Our practice period has, I would say, and I think constructively, become considerably less monastic through many adaptations to make it work for people in our culture, people with families demanding jobs. So just a reminder, our fall practice period begins September 27th, 2 weeks from Sunday.
A week from Sunday.
A week from Sunday, okay. And I wanted more rest. Okay, 1 week from Sunday. I think Monday's the registration deadline. Is that, or is it past?
We can flex that. People can still sign up.
Okay. She's going to let us in. So please, armed bandits await the laggards at the pass. If you haven't registered, get ready. What does devotion look like in our practice period? We don't chant the Heart Sutra 100 times a day. But we do chant it in the morning service, and it will be wonderful if a substantial number of us can be here for that. Maybe one day a week, maybe two or three or four. But we can all do some practice on arising in the morning to remind us of our vows, and simply to join us together with the rest of our practicing community. I think we have time to talk about a couple portions of the Heart Sutra. And by the way, there's a mantra at the end, and a mantra is a kind of incantation. Not something we read to parse the meaning. That's even true with the sutras when we chant them. But to put ourselves into the language, this language that is an expression of our devotion. But there is a mantra at the end, but it's interesting to note that the entire Heart Sutra was a mantra. It was translators from more than one translator, but including Swansong, from the Sanskrit to Chinese, that added the word sutra. So it's there to be chanted, to be entered into, and when you get familiar with it, there are all these things. No birth, no death, no emptiness, body, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, six sense objects, six consciousness. So you wonder, what are those six? What are these? There's so many things in our ordinary relationship to language we can get into thinking about. And they have great value for that when we have a chance to study. But that's not what chanting a sutra is about. It's about joining with the community, heart, body, voice, in this expression of devotion and what we are devoted to. It's the devotion of the moment of expression with the community. And I think of it sometimes in the Heart Sutra as this wonderfully concise summary of the whole of the Buddha's teaching as we had it, just kind of bathing in that, raising it up in this way. So as I said, we would not spend time with We don't have time to deal with each of the portions of the Buddha's teaching that are mentioned in here. That's something for workshop or class. We talked about the 12 links and the no birth, no death a bit. We talked about the skandhas. One of the most striking things in reading it, I think, for many of us is the negation of the, what comes across as negation of what we know as the core statement of the Buddha's teaching, the Four Noble Truths. In this translation of Thich Nhat Hanh, ill being, what we usually call suffering, the causes of ill being, the end of ill being, the path, insight and attainment are also not separate self entities. I was kind of cold this morning. And when I get cold at this time of the year, I begin to think, oh no, summer's over. But I don't suffer from the end of summer or add to the suffering of just being a little chilly by saying, oh no, again. It's the end of summer because I know that spring is completely present in the end of summer. Right? The end of summer is boundless. It's not some separate self entity, this suffering. Yeah, there's a little suffering. I would like this wonderful summer we've had to continue. That kind of suffering is pervasive in life. Everything arises, some kind of suffering arises with everything. Something that we can see as a little ill being. But we know that it is boundless. It is part of the whole system of seasons and weather and the climate and the planet and all that, and it's our life. So that's the end of the agony of thinking that we have to be rid of it. Sooner or later, we'll get rid of the end of summer altogether. Boundlessness is the end of ill being. Freedom from suffering. Because when we see that suffering, that freedom, from the end of summer, because when we see that in the end of summer is all the other seasons, boundless. And so the cessation of suffering, the end of suffering, there isn't any end of suffering because suffering already isn't. Right? This is part of the ongoing cycle. It is boundless. Nothing that has a separate self-entity that we can identify. And suffering is pervasive in life. Suffering has a cause which we can discover. There is an end to suffering. And there is a path that helps us with that. And ill being does not exist as a separate thing. It is boundless. The causes of suffering don't exist as a separate thing. It is boundless. It comes up within the patterns of our whole life. The path doesn't exist as that thing called a path which you can undertake. It exists as myriad energies and teaching. It is boundless. The Buddha spelled out a path. We have a path spelled out in our teaching. But what all those things mean that define the path are different for Sue, different for every one of us. It is boundless. Does that pretty clear a sense of what we mean by emptiness of these things that are so important? Now, at the end of the Heart Sutra, there is a gatha, a mantra. And I would like to just mention, Byakaran went to a workshop with Dan Brown where he presented his understanding or rendering of the gatha at the end of the Heart Sutra, and I think it's a worthwhile insight that she has shared with us. So just to mention some things about what these words are. Gatha, gatha. Gatha means beyond, and Dan Brown's understanding, gatha, gatha means beyond thought. Or I don't think this is so much a translation as a rendering or a way of interpreting, but gatha, gatha, beyond thought. Not locked up in the world of thinking. As I mentioned earlier this morning, I think this not thinking of Dogen, non-thinking, I like to think of it as simple, pure awareness, not being caught up in the mind, letting go of the train of thought that pulls us away. The gentle effort of concentration. Paragate. Beyond personal identity. With our quiet mind, we can begin to see through all the stories about me and see the deeper course of our shared, only shared life. And we can begin to live, I think, a different question than what's in it for me. Paragate, going beyond personal identity. Parasangati, beyond constructions of time. We talk a lot about the present moment, but the present moment is not the present moment as opposed to the past and the future. The present moment is all time, as this, here, now. Bodhi, awakened awareness, is the words he gives to it. Bodhi, sometimes translated as enlightenment or enlightening. A clear mind that is this moment. In Byakaran's words, it is the ability to welcome each moment exactly as it is, as life itself. Bodhisva, svaha, beyond individual consciousness. And Dan Brown translates it as, actually I'm not certain if this is Dan Brown's words or, no, I think it is, or Bjorkren's, as ooh, ah, wow. It's just an exclamation. And actually, when I read that, I'm not so sure, because it seems like, ooh, ah, wow. Maybe that trivializes a little bit. Because I think what it's really pointing to is what is inexpressible in language. Bodhidharma said, when you come to the place where language cannot go, that is Zen. I think that's svaha. Of course, there's a word put on it, svaha. Let's stop there, because you had lots of interesting questions yesterday, and you probably have more today. One little report about these translations. I did check the translation of the Heart Sutra that is in the Soto School scriptures is exactly what we have in our chant book. And I think we all, the local centers, more or less agreed that we would use that, so we have a kind of standard translation. I was not able to put my fingers on right away the copy I mentioned of a very similar translation to that, which has Katagiri Roshi's name on it. And my recollection is, I may be wrong, but this is what's coming up for me, that there was that early English translation, and Kobenchino sounds right to me, what you say. And Katagiri Roshi made a few amendments in that. I think they were kind of minor, but they were significant words to him that he changed, and that was what we used with him at Minnesota Zen Meditation Center. So all of these resources we have from the great devotion of a number of teachers and translators. I think it's fascinating to know that a translator had that big an impact on the development of the practices. Of course, he was a teacher also. So what's coming up for you?
I know it's a very basic question, but the beyond thought, the gate, is that beyond judgments and discriminative thinking, because I just have thoughts.
Yes, I would say so. That's all thoughts.
So I just have those things coming in, but then if I get caught up in my own judgments about them and how I'm wrapping my own self around it, is that what it's?
Yes. Okay. Yes, I think so.
I really have to be careful not to be I gotta shut out these thoughts or try and put them down.
Yeah, that doesn't work very well. We have to welcome what comes, but we have to see it for what it is. And that may mean we don't get quite engaged with it like we are in the habit of doing. B.
Would Soha maybe be the thing that's big enough to hold it all? The
Sava?
The right word, or the I don't have a word for it, but it's the Swaha, yeah. Is that the,
yeah.
Do you think that's what is, everything is in, I don't know how to say it very well.
Nobody does. Yes. Yes, I think so.
Just kind of like a container, but bigger than that.
Yeah. And the word I came up with was wondrous. Mm. That Swaha is something like wondrous. Is wondrous. It's what we say when we're filled with wonder.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've heard there's a sangha in Spain that translates it as olé.
Oh, good. Olé. That's great.
Well, We now have these three translations, and it's just sort of like how what are you thinking we might do with three translations of this?
Well, that's an interesting question, and I haven't really got to that place yet. I think, they're there. I've heard of somebody, I think maybe Joan Halifax's community, I think they have begun chanting it, put it in their service and using that translation. And so I don't know what, they're going to be there as resources for us. I think they're very useful for studying, as we have seen with this little exploration. And we can certainly do more of that. And maybe, when we're looking at our chanting, maybe we will decide we want to put one or two of them into our chanting library, maybe for occasional use. I don't know. I don't have any thoughts beyond that, Lillian.
I'm curious, Swan Song, the Swan Song, how do we say his name? Is he one of the six patriarchs?
No.
Huh.
No, he's an, and that's the curious thing to me about him is, why didn't we know about him?
Yeah.
Maybe some people did, but I didn't. No, so he kind of comes at the tail end of the six ancestors. He overlaps at least where Nung, I think, and maybe Hongren a little bit. I'm not sure. I'll have to check the exact dates, but.
Sometimes we don't chant the English translation during the month. What language or version is that?
Sino-Japanese, we call it. It is, as I understand it, it's a Japanese pronunciation of the Chinese. It's not everyday Japanese. So if we were to chant or start reciting that version of the Heart Sutra with a visiting Japanese family, they wouldn't know what we were talking about. But it's what the monks chant in the monastery in Japan.
And I think almost none of them understand what it means. No, it's true. So it's an interesting question of the meaning of understanding the meaning of the words, because I, from what I understand, I think the average Japanese monk in the monastery doesn't understand those words in the Heart Sutra.
Think so, which helps us maybe appreciate, I mean, at least to see that the importance is not in analyzing the meaning, in its use as a sothat.
I kind of do remember the first time I chanted the Heart Sutra.
Oh, good.
And it was kind of like that. I didn't know exactly what it meant, but it moved me in some way. I don't know why exactly. And pretty soon after, like within a few years after that, I started studying to be ordained, and part of my practice was chanting that every day. I think I alternated the Heart Sutra and some other sutra every other day, but so at least every other day, I was chanting it, and I didn't really know what it meant.
Oh.
It was a devotional practice, and it still is.
Were you chanting it in English or?
In English, yeah.
That's nice. I started chanting it daily when I began working on this, and just thinking about it so much, kind of alternating the two translations, and it's a different thing when you sort of let yourself absorb it like that.
Oh, I just remember the other thing I chanted was the Song of the Grass Roof Hermitage.
Oh, yeah.
That was
oh.
The alternate day.
Okay. That's lovely. B.
So I don't know if this is true in this tradition at all, but in yogic traditions and chanting, the mantras are, and it makes me think of the sutras, are said to have an energy of awakening. And I'm imagining that the Heart Sutra and other sutras have similar inherent in repeating them. They have this ability to awaken the sutra. I'm imagining.
Well, you know, I can relate to that. And I tend to think of it, being the Western rational realist that we are, that is something not inherent in the words themselves, but something we put into it with our understanding. But that maybe is pretty limited. That might not be a very adequate way of looking at it. But I remember when I was Doan at Hokioji, in my first session there, I was told I would be Doan, and I had almost no Doan experience. So I spent the whole night in my tent poring over the book and what that was about. But there's a huge cottonwood tree behind the house there at Hokioji, and I just went out and I told that tree, it's up to you. I can't do this. You know, so I can appreciate having some energy out there beyond ourselves. Maybe we're finished.